Hello, and welcome to the Advent AM podcast, Risk and Business, and especially welcome to part two of our podcast around obsolescence management, risk and counterfeiting. I'm delighted to be joined again by a fantastic panel. So let's just quickly go around the table and introduce yourselves again. So we'll start with Alex, please.
Hi, everyone. I'm Alex Johnston-Morfas, founder and director at Simply BD. I'm a nuclear engineer by background, so I'll be bringing a bit of nuclear industry thoughts on the topic.
Hi, Alex. Welcome back. Mark.
Hi, everyone. Mark Broadhead from Certify Holdings and SMT Corp. I'm the business development director. I'm here to provide a perspective from electronic component distribution and testing angle in relation to counterfeit and the impact that it has on counterfeit electronics and the impact that it has on obsolescence.
Brilliant. Welcome, Mark. Thank you. Hi, Manu.
Hi, delighted to be back. I'm Manu Grundy. I am the CTO for IOM UK, and IOM is the Institute for Obsolescence Management.
Welcome back. Hi, John.
Hi, so I'm John Dyson. I work for Winslow Adaptics. We are obsolescence management solution providers. I'm also vice chair of IOM UK and Ireland.
Thanks, welcome back. And Mike, hi.
Yeah, hi, I'm Mike Schwarm. I'm the chief growth officer for Certify Holdings and SMT Corp. So Mark already talked a little bit about what we do, so I won't repeat that.
Brilliant, thanks guys, and welcome back. So I just want to start by, and maybe this is one for you, John, but exploring the aspect of obsolescence as a systemic issue in industries that are particularly reliant on legacy systems.
I think, yeah, there are a series of sort of systemic problems that we have with the availability of products on a system level. And I think that can be affected by components. It can be affected by sort of ongoing manufacturing of spares and so on and so forth. And it's something that, you know, the heads of organizations need to be looking at to make sure that they have availability of whatever it is that the system is.
I know, Mike, in the previous episode, you mentioned the long life cycle for the development of defense armaments and capabilities, and you know, I was just reading over the weekend how long it takes from somebody first having the idea for an aircraft carrier to it actually ending up in the water, for example. So that's got to be a particular systemic issue there as well.
Yeah, so in defense, it's a particularly daunting issue because you not only do you have systems that have been fielded for 30, 40, 50 plus years. The AMRAAM missile, for example, air-to-air missile, was originally developed in the 1960s, right? So that's been out there. It might even have been the 50s, but it's been out there forever, right? So supporting something like that, even though you have modules that are constantly being redesigned, you still have a base obsolescence problem. And to your point, Mike, the issue you have is something like an F-35 or an aircraft carrier or something that takes a very long time to design. Could have significant obsolescence problems by the time it's even fielded.
So suddenly you've got a new product and it's already obsolete.
Yeah, it's a new product. It's just been fielded and now you can't support it, or you have challenges supporting it. Is usually what ends up coming into play.
And that must be the same within nuclear then, Alex, because I mean these aren't nuclear reactors aren't something that you just discard after a couple of years, are they?
Definitely. And yeah, exactly the same in terms of now you see nuclear plants taking at least 10 years to be built. So it's exactly the same. We get to the point where it's already obsolete when it starts to operate. But I guess we have to probably learn from each other and share our experiences to see how you're managing it and what we're doing.
And I guess that's really where the role of IOM as the Institute of Obsolescence Management comes in, Manu.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right there. It's all about the knowledge share across the industries because, yes, we've talked about aerospace and defence and the nuclear side of things and rail, but that problem is really in any industry. So whether it is the automotive, and yes, they have got a shorter life cycle. I guess a car design is out there for, let's say, 7 years and then supported for another 20. But obsolescence happens in the shorter life cycle industries as well. If we talk oil and gas and energy and white goods, it is everywhere. And I guess we as IOM help with sharing those case studies and learn from each other, because it's not a unique challenge to any industry.
So what are the implications then of when manufacturers decide that they're not going to keep making stuff, whether it's parts or components or electrical items or even software developers, when they decide they're not going to keep producing the same thing? What are the implications then to businesses?
Well, it's continuity of supply and brand perception or damage, that's the risk here. So if we talk engineer level, well, the engineer has got to find a solution to supply that part. What can they do to source something that's form, fit and function to still ensure the product is going out and you don't have a line stop as such? For a business perspective, well, you have got to manage the risk, the reputation and the cost that comes with it as an organization, because any change costs money. And I guess to a certain extent, you could try to build in a mid-design refresh or a design that you already know you're doing and you are updating it there and it's planned instead of being caught off guard as such.
I think something I just want to add on that is it just shows the importance of relationship with your suppliers. So if they can come to you before they've actually discontinued the product, then it's really the best place to be. And then I think in part one of the podcast, we talked about the potential of buying IP of them or helping them potentially to keep going as well. That's something the nuclear industry does, because it has to. So I think that's just a really important thing to try and build that trust within your industry and them coming to you rather than you having to discover the fact afterwards.
Yeah, there are actually a bunch of ways that people try to work through that problem. Manu and Alex gave a few of those examples. Trying to recreate a device, functionally emulate it, form, fit, function, drop in replacement. That's another way. Going to the open market where there might be excess parts and sourcing them. But anytime you lose traceability, you've got to be very careful, right? You have to have a whole set of requirements and standards that you're following to make sure that they are what they say they are. Third-party licensed manufacturing is another way, all the way up to, you know, finding excess dye and repackaging it before you get to, I have to redesign this system. But all these things are, there's a ton of different ways people try to deal with this problem.
Right, but it's a fine line between repackaging and counterfeiting.
It is. I think of it in a broader context of not just, you know, parts that are in the open market. It's anytime you've lost traceability to the original manufacturer, now you've got an issue, right? You've got something that you have a risk that you have to mitigate.
So I mean, I've been reading up on the increase in all sorts of industries across all sorts of products of counterfeit goods entering into the supply chain. And it seems to me that part of that is in response to a vacuum that's created as a result of the original parts no longer being made. Mark?
Yeah, I mean, we could sort of row this back to, you know, the pandemic and all the issues that were really caused in the supply chain as a result of that. Buyers became desperate to try and maintain production facilities and delivering products on time. And as a result of that, ultimately people end up shortcutting their processes and procedures for ensuring that they're buying the right products for the application. And that ultimately opens the door to the risk of counterfeit entering the supply chain.
Do you think that was exacerbated by the previous move away from the sort of stockpiling, having a warehouse of parts, to just-in-time supply?
Yeah, so Mike mentioned on the previous podcast, the relationship between, just in time and just in case. And I think ultimately, there's somewhere in the middle ground there that that manufacturers need to sort of create a position where they're buying ahead to maintain, suitable levels of stock of key components that they require, versus overloading their warehouse and causing tension within their cash flow ultimately. So there's probably a sweet spot for every organization between just in time and just in case.
And there's got to be a particular fine line to walk where you've got products or components that take a longer time to manufacture in the first place, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So we mentioned in the first part of this podcast, the obsolescence can be caused by a whole range of factors. We mentioned, geopolitical, technological, man-made disasters, all sorts of things. And I suppose what organizations need to be building an understanding of that in alongside a mentality of managing counterfeit risk as well. So we, in the IT world, it's something that we have a particular challenge with in terms of counterfeit chips. And, Mike mentioned, when you lose sight of the original manufacturer, how do you then have the confidence that the product you're putting into your network, in my world, is going to continue to give you the level of security that you expect from those components? But I guess it has, other impacts as well in terms of safety, guarantees that things will perform in the way that you expect them to when you've replaced an original product with a counterfeit product. What are the sort of things that our audience should be thinking about when it comes to counterfeiting?
So I'll give my thoughts on that. So the US DoD and the UK MOD both flow down sets of requirements to their supply base. And that's actually probably forms a big part of the answer once you're talking about untraceable products. In the US DoD, I'm probably more familiar with every contract in the US DoD flows down a set of risk mitigations that need to be employed once you're dealing with, in this case, the risk of counterfeit parts, which really is anything that doesn't have manufacturing traceability. And you can get very quickly to whether the standards are actually defined to mitigate that. And Mark kind of alluded to a couple of them. So there's a sourcing standard, which is actually an automotive standard, AS6081, which talks about how you source untraceable products. And then there's another automotive standard, AS6171, that talks about how you test products that don't have traceability. So it's all defined. It's just not universally followed, right? So it's not always enforced. And I think it's only within certain sectors that it's actually applicable, right? So when you start talking about the risk, it's not just a DoD risk. It's not just an MOD risk. It's an energy sector risk. It's a medical sector risk. It's an automotive sector. So all the things we talked about, it's the standards are there and they work and they've been vetted, over several years. They're just not applied and they're not followed universally.
Because on one hand, it's a different risk when you're buying a counterfeit part for a vintage car that is part of your hobby, versus buying counterfeit parts and putting them into critical national infrastructure.
Yeah, I would be careful the counterfeit versus replacement or functionally equivalent. Like people sell things that are like, there's a company in China, for instance, Fudan Micro. They sell a drop-in replacement for a Kintec 7, a Xilinx part, AMD Xilinx part. They don't advertise it as a counterfeit part. They advertise it as a form, fit, function replacement for a Xilinx Kintec 7. So they're not, it's not counterfeit. I mean, it's just the same thing, right? Now, could somebody like take that part and then paint it and say that it's a Xilinx Kintec 7? Of course, then it becomes a counterfeit part. So I think just be careful, because I play guitar. I can buy a pickup for a Fender Telecaster that's not a Fender pickup, but I know what I'm getting, right? So I just have to be careful about how we define those terms.
So counterfeit is where a part is being passed off as an original part.
Yeah, something different than what it is, right? So, an original part, you could kind of call it.
Right, okay. So that's an interesting distinction then, and probably one that I hadn't myself thought through. So for example, you can buy different makes of LaserJet ink to put into a printer, but you know that you're not buying the original ink manufacturer.
Until HP tells you that you can't use it in their system, yeah.
I think it depends on the risk, doesn't it? The counterfeit or the product actually has for you. You know, the ink, the worst that's going to happen is that you can't print your page. You know, if you have an aircraft or something like that, rail defense, that the potential that you could be opening up is catastrophic. You know, and I think the important thing from an obsolescence perspective is that I think, Mike, you alluded to this at the beginning of this segment, that obsolescence creates a vacuum which people can actually sort of get drawn into to produce parts, to fake parts, and so on and so forth. So I totally agree with you, Mike, about the difference between fit form function parts and fake parts, and it's important that we draw that distinction.
But how would an organization know how would they know that what they're getting isn't an original part? How good are counterfeit parts, and what sort of things should organizations be looking for?
They're getting much better. So we've actually had instances recently where we've gone through the full suite of AS6171 tests, including electrical, functional, and performance tests over environmental conditions. And we've only seen minor differences when you're, say, running at the very high temperature and you're doing a full parameter assessment on an electronic component where you see the failure there. So the counterfeit, particularly the clone counterfeits, meaning that they've been designed from the ground up to emulate or mimic an original device, are very good in some instances. So you have to run a lot more testing than you would normally have. And you know, so we do testing for companies that are making form, fit, function equivalents, and they advertise them as that, right? They're not advertising them as something that, you know, advertising them as the original device. And we do testing of devices that have been faked, right? I mean, we don't know that until we've discovered them. But it's becoming, with clones, the evolution of clones over the last 12, 13 years, it's a lot harder to detect them now than it had been. 12 years ago, mostly what you saw was remarked components that were harvested and then painted and either said, hey, these are new, or these are something different or better than what they were. But now you're actually seeing ground up, you know, rebuild parts that are meant to emulate the original part, and they're a lot harder to detect. So you have to have much more sophisticated means of detection.
Because I think this is something that we've become familiar with as a consumer level, and you know, a lot has been done, certainly here in the UK, with you know, watchdogs and trying to raise awareness about the sort of safety element of buying counterfeit electronic goods. We have had a lot of publicity over the last couple of years around counterfeit batteries for e-bikes, for example, which in some cases the impact has been catastrophic in that they have caught fire, houses have burned down, and people have lost their lives. And that's at a consumer level. So when you take that up to, you know, rail, defense, aerospace, nuclear, you know, all of these critical industries, doing something similar to that at that level would be not just an individual catastrophe, but could have a national catastrophe element to it as well. So I think about it from the manufacturer's perspective, why would a manufacturer want to continue to make parts for obsolescent systems or make parts that they consider to be obsolete and out of date?
They don't.
Unless there is something in it for them, financial benefit for them, they wouldn't. And I think that comes back to the topic of as much as technology advances and as much as new things come in, that will make the risk of making other parts that are legacy and that are no longer commercially viable, that the obsolescence just creeps in faster because of that. So our job will just get more difficult as we go along with that.
There is an opportunity for, third party remanufacture. Let's separate that from manufacture. There is an opportunity. There's a whole ecosystem of people that are doing this in all the industries and all the highly regulated industries. And it's a great way. You some of these huge organizations that start the initial designs, that make the initial pieces of equipment, just can't. Their financial system is such that they're too expensive to run for these tiny volumes just required for maintenance. So if you can actually legitimately and to the right standard and so on, pass that down the supply chain, if you like, to other organizations who are sort of leaner, more nimble, able to sort of get the cost base down and continue to manufacture those components as fit, form, function replacements. You've got a great economic argument. You've got a great quality argument.
Is there a place then in all of this for new and emerging capabilities, like for example, 3D printing, to be able to take the place for more expensive and more complicated manufacturing and assembly lines?
That could work for things like connectors and stuff like that, but it really doesn't work for electronic parts. So it doesn't, you're talking about die level stuff now, and it really is when you get down to like, I know this is, I'm being very specific with defense here, but when you get out and you're talking about low volumes and, supporting programs that have been out there for 10, 15, 20, 30 years, it's just not economically viable anymore. I've worked for tier 3, tier 4 electronics manufacturers, and end of lifing products is the only, and Manu actually talked about this in the first podcast. The only real reason why you would do it at that point is reputational, right? Because you have a customer that you're supporting and you don't want to disappoint them. But at some point, it's just not economically feasible anymore. You have to end of life a product, and there's no economic benefit in somebody else coming along in a lot of cases to do a replacement for that.
And that's true across, right the way through from firmware through to software, through to the electrical components, mechanical components. In all of those cases, you can't expect any organization to continue to support every version of everything they've ever created.
Right. Yeah. And you lose the recipe at some point because it becomes a bigger risk, right? Because even as the company, I've had situations where I've worked for companies that, even though you were the original manufacturer, you've lost the recipe on how to build it, or, some critical people left, 10 years ago and you just, there was some like ingrained knowledge that left with them. And so that's not always the ultimate panacea, is just to have the original manufacturer recreate something or continue to manufacture something that's been out there for 10, 15, 20 years. That could be a risk in and of itself.
Yeah, and I know, going back to the counterfeiting side of things, when we start to bring counterfeit software, counterfeit electrical goods, counterfeit chips into critical infrastructure and start using them, the potential for that then to introduce holes, security flaws that could allow networks to be attacked and potentially taken down is increased significantly as a result of that.
Yeah, there's actually a guy that ran, it was a bunch of like 100 shell companies. He got sentenced last year. I think it was 20, maybe 20, maybe the year before, by the Department of Justice in the U.S. And he was basically selling all kinds of like counterfeit network, Cisco network equipment. And they made their way into hospitals and military applications and all kinds of things, and ended up causing a whole bunch of problems, right? Infrastructure going down and whatnot. We could put a link to the case here, but it was really an inch. And it was going on for like 10 years, and Cisco was actually sending him like cease and desist letters, and he was still doing it. So I think he was operating out of Florida or something like that, but he actually got convicted, I think it was last year or 2023, one or the other.
Is that the incident, Mike, where he'd actually been using boards that have been manufactured in China, taken off of the production line to a subcontractor, and they'd use counterfeit components that had a back door or a
No, that's a different one. This was, he was just taking old like equipment and just relabeling it effectively.
But the whole Trojan horse back door, you know, risk is a huge one that, is almost a sleeping giant out there at the moment, because we really don't know how many back doors or Trojan horses there are in critical infrastructure and defense platforms.
And there are less friendly nation states out there who have a vested interest in getting some of these counterfeit products into our infrastructure, aren't there?
Yeah, that's got to be the ultimate aim. You know, if you start, I know I think about it from time to time, and I see, you know, the infiltration of let's just say EV vehicles from other states, you know, from China, for example. And that's just a building repository of kit, if you like, in the environment that that could be used against the state where they're being used. It's quite scary when you think about it.
So I guess, you know, this comes back to something we started with in part one, Manu, is that organizations need to be building proactive strategies and processes now for managing obsolescence, not waiting until something becomes obsolete.
Yeah, totally. It's about having a plan, knowing what you're doing, mapping your parts, where are the risky parts, where are the ones with the greatest impact, and having a plan for those ones is key. And then I guess it's mapping and knowing your supply chain of who is actually in your supply chain at the next tiers down. Where is the production happening? Where are you sourcing it from? So when natural disasters like earthquakes or tsunamis or anything strike, you actually know what parts are impacted and when they are impacting you.
Yeah, so I've been part of a new policy group here in the UK called Cybersecurity and Business Resilience, which is part of an extension of an all-party parliamentary group around cybersecurity. And I introduced the topic of obsolescence at a round table where we were talking about artificial intelligence in healthcare just a couple of weeks ago. And I have to be absolutely honest, a lot of people around the table, their heads just looked up and went, what on earth is this that he's talking about? And I don't think, as a lifelong security practitioner, it is only in the last couple of months since John and I have been talking that I've seriously thought about the impact that obsolescence has in my world, in the security world. And I would be prepared to hypothesize that across a whole range of other professions, obsolescence and the risk of counterfeiting as a result of obsolescence is not something that is talked about enough. Would you back me up on that, guys?
Yes, absolutely.
So how do we raise the subject of obsolescence then, other than, you know, we're trying to do as part of this podcast, and as I will certainly continue to do at events that I attend throughout this year, which probably won't be core obsolescence events, but certainly obsolescence will become part of my lexicon going forward. What can we do as business leaders in order to raise this topic?
I think it's openly talking about it. I mean, I will do a shameless plug here for IOM because, like, you invited me. But it's join organizations like IOM. We have got a few global or chapters in various countries where people talk about these topics to promote it. It's something for every generation. It isn't something that's going away. And just by talking and getting people inspired about it, I think is the way forward.
I agree. I believe, you know, organizations like IOM, they really pull together, you know, across many different industries, getting everybody in the same room, having that conversation and exploring what best practice looks like, and working, you know, collaboratively to, you know, develop solutions and improve mindsets to mitigate the risk. And beyond ION, there are, you know, very sort of very sector specific working groups as well. For example, we work with the MOD's counterfeit awareness group. So that's very MOD supply chain specific. But as leaders in this space, it's up to us to educate that audience with what counterfeit mitigation looks like from a sourcing perspective.
Yeah, the other thing, I absolutely agree with what Manu and Mark said. There's a lot of really, you know, IAM CALS. So we've spoken at most of those things in the last year or two. But we are also pretty heavily engaged with both policymakers and lawmakers, particularly in the U.S. on this risk. And it is interesting because they'll, you know, when you have the conversations initially, they immediately want to push you over to, oh, you should go talk to the Department of Defense guys. And it's like, no, this is a bigger problem than that, right? This affects all of our critical national infrastructure, not just defense. So that's another way to heighten the awareness, is really just be engaged with folks that can actually influence policy, influence law, that kind of thing.
Is this a challenge that can be solved by legislation alone?
Not alone, but that will help, right? The recognition that there is actually legislation last year in the U.S. Coming through a kind of a bipartisan bill in the Senate to talk about sourcing of computers and things like that. And so, but that doesn't, even in of itself, that doesn't solve the problem, because a lot of times it's what's inside of it that's the issue, not the actual, you know, where you're getting it from. So yes, policy can be a big influence. We can see that because the UK MOD has a policy, DOD has a policy, but it's not being broadly applied, and it's not being applied kind of to everything that has a traceability issue.
It feels to me a lot of what we've talked about in these two sessions, what we're really talking about here is organizational resilience.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I would agree with that. I often think, like, you know, because when we're talking to people about supply chain risk, you're inevitably talking to the head of the supply chain or engineers that deal with obsolescence and counterfeit mitigation. I often think that I should be talking to the legal counsel for these companies to so they can understand the risk that they have of this occurring, right? If you field a system that ends up, you know, causing a mission failure or loss of life, think about the risk that poses to your company.
Because this feels to me like, first and foremost, and please do correct me if you feel that I'm wrong here, but feels to me that this is first and foremost a business challenge, and therefore it should be something that is an integral part of the leadership conversation, not something that is an engineering problem or supply problem or software problem.
Definitely. And I think actually there's been, you know, what's gone wrong a little bit with that has been a focus on short term cost reduction, you know, because everything to do with obsolescence management is, you know, it's not going to instantly pay you back on your investment. It is an investment, and it should be seen as one. But it is the ability to reduce spend going forward. So actually over the life cycle of products, you can actually reduce your spend by properly managing the obsolescence that's in front of you.
I think that's really interesting, John, because I think obsolescence management would be seen in the short term as an upfront increase in cost rather than something that was going to reduce cost further down the line.
Definitely. I mean, we see all the time. You know, we'd love more and more organizations to come and join us at IOM, and some people are hesitant to pay in, you know, and at the end of the day, that's just, I don't know how. Sometimes I wonder how we can get the message across. And you said at the beginning, you didn't even know there was an organization that looks after obsolescence management. And we have so much more to shout about this and to get our message across, to get the value proposition across. And I thank you for this platform today to some degree to be able to do that.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to have to bring us to a close for part two here. But again, thank you to all of you for your expertise, for giving up your time here, and for helping to raise this important issue to everybody that's listened or watched this podcast, I would urge you to go to the International Institute of Obsolescent Management and have a look at the important work that they're doing. We've mentioned a number of standards and regulations across these two sessions, which we'll make sure people have links for, so they can go and find them without having to spend too much time looking for them themselves. I personally think that obsolescence management and security management are two sides of the same coin, and I really look forward to doing more collaboration with IOM going forward. I think the conversation needs to be continued. So thank you for helping us to start that conversation. For those of you that work in security or a business leadership role, I would urge you to start this conversation within your own organization. And maybe start by just asking that simple question: do we have an obsolescence management policy? Might be a good place to start, do you think, Manu?
Yeah. Yes, it's asking the question and making that mind shift of, it's not just the engineer who's responsible for managing, it is a business decision to be proactive, and the benefits that come from proactive management of your obsolescence are wider span than just being able to supply that one product. It is a better thing to do for the sustainability aspect, for your security, for your risk reduction, for your, I guess your brand will carry more value by you being actively managing those things.
Brilliant. Thank you. A great way to finish off. Your brand is everything in business, and obsolescence management is absolutely vital to managing and protecting your brand. Thanks very much to Alex, to Mark, to Manu.
Thank you.
To John and to Mike for giving us their time on these two sessions. Really appreciate it, and I look forward to keeping the conversation going. This has been the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business. If you want to know more about obsolescence management, then reach out to Manu at IOM. If you want to know more about what we're doing here at Advent IM, then you can follow us on all of our socials. As always, please reach out, ask us questions, and keep the conversation going. But for now, goodbye and thank you.